Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Good evening, everyone. This is Ken McKeon. Welcome to Nature's Talk Show on tonight's The Fine Art of Paleontology. I'm joined, as always, with my co-host, Ken Borman. We both want to thank you for joining us. And as always, Ken and I want to invite you to www.naturestalkshow.com and join our chat room with us. And Ken will be fielding questions as he does and comments and stuff for our show tonight, because we've got a really cool show that for our listeners. It's a little bit of hard rock geology tonight. We're going to be talking about, of course, the volcanoes. But before we get underway, Ken, hello.
Hello, Ken. How are you?
Pretty good. Now, before we get underway on the show, Ken, you was this weekend at the NEC conference, and it might be kind of fun just to talk to our listeners about some of the other things that you and I do, such as fish and stuff, and what it was like when you was there for give us a brief little rundown real quick.
Oh, it was great. It was a fantastic weekend. We drove out to Rocky Hill, Connecticut on last Thursday, and drove back yesterday. And it was a huge drive for me. I'm no spring chicken anymore, and it was 11 hours each way.
Oh, my gosh.
But it was fun. I met a lot of old friends. I made a lot of new friends. A whole weekend of talking fish. I was there with Tom, our owner, and Ray, another host from here at Nature's Talk Show. We interviewed a stack of people, some speakers, some attendees, some vendors. It was great fun. Go and check out Nature's Talk Show on our YouTube channel, and you'll see some of the videos we took of the interviews.
Very cool. A couple of years ago, as I mentioned to some of our listeners, I was at the NEC conference as a guest speaker, and I did a talk on the evolution of the fishes, the freshwater fishes. So that was a whole lot of fun as well, and explaining how, the various aspects that we talk about on our show here of convergence and divergence and what we see with the different fishes. So that was a lot of fun. But, Ken, we need to let our listeners know here that this coming month, that the Fine Art of Paleontology team, you and myself, are going to be together for the first time in London, Ontario, and they should come up and see us. What do you want to tell our listeners about the KWAC show?
Yeah, it's actually a combination. There'll be the Tank Topics team together, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because Ron Bishop will be there as well. He's the president of KWAC, and as well as the president of the London Aquarium Society, he's putting on the KWAC show. Now, KWAC is the Canadian Association of Aquarium Clubs. And we have an annual show, bringing a whole whack of speakers. You're included this year, Ken. You're one of our speakers. And another one is Leslie Dick, who was the convention chairperson this past weekend.
Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah, she's a wonderful lady.
Yeah, she's one of our speakers, so you'll be able to renew your acquaintance with her.
Yeah.
As well as another three or four speakers, so it'll be a fun weekend. It's a Canadian long weekend, which is the weekend before your weekend, your long weekend, isn't it, Ken?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right before, yeah.
So if you're anywhere near London, Ontario, come along. It'll be a great weekend, and you'll have fun.
Hey, Ken.
Well, they can say hi to us. We'll talk paleontology with them, or we can talk fish with them. We can talk just about any subject that folks want to talk to us about, we can discuss it with them. You know, that's one of the fun things about the shows that you and I get to do together, is how much nature we get to learn about ourselves. You know, because to me, every show, Ken, that we do is a learning experience, even for myself. As you know, I've been around for a long time studying nature since I was a kid, and just I still always I'm learning stuff too. You know, it's just fantastic.
It is, certainly is. Mary, did you have something you needed to say?
I do. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, we can.
Okay. I forgot, too. You guys have a raffle.
Yes, we did.
And
it was.
Do you have the info?
It was drawn on YouTube. I don't have it. Tom has it, actually.
Okay.
But the raffle tickets were drawn on YouTube, and You can see it if you go to our YouTube channel. You can see the draw. We didn't announce names, but we did show the tickets that won. We have all the winners' information, and they'll be going out this week.
Thank you.
Yep, very cool. Now we'll probably have some artwork up for raffle at the KOAC show as well, Ken. I'll be bringing some artwork for a display and as well, to show off. So there's a good chance that if any of our listeners happen to be there, that they can win themselves a painting as well, because I definitely want to raffle off some artwork for the show and stuff there. So
that's great. A lot of people are looking forward to that too, Ken.
I am looking forward to. It's been a long time since I've been to Ontario. I actually used to live not too far from where you live. I grew up in northern or central Indiana, and went to college at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. Yes, and got to visit Ontario one time. And Ken, one of my favorite things when I got there, when we crossed the river at Port Huron into Canada, and probably one of the most lovely ladies I ever met was manning the desk there at the port of entry on the Canadian side, and she had this beautiful red, the red jacket on and stuff, and I was like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, you would have come across into Sarnia in that instance.
Oh, yeah. It was really cool. Like I said, it was a fun experience going up and visiting Canada and stuff. And when I get there, I got a war story to tell you. You're going to laugh at.
Okay. I'll
it'll
look
be
forward
fun.
To it.
All right. But anyway, on with the show.
Before we really start, I must make an apology about last week's show. For some reason, the chat room didn't update, and there were two questions, actually, that I missed. I didn't see until after the show. So maybe, actually, I think I know who asked them. So maybe if I ask them to you now, you can answer it. And if it's a person I think of, I'm sure he's listening.
All right. Yeah, please. Let's.
Okay.
What we got?
Well, the first question is there a type of rock that is especially fossil rich compared to others?
Limestones.
So limestone in all its forms?
Most limestones. Limestone is usually made up of the shells of animals. And even massive limestones can be made up of just millions of little tiny shells that are made out of calcium carbonate. But from my experience, limestone has been probably the most fossiliferous type of rocks I've come across. All the way from Indiana to here in the Southwest. And the second most common type of rock that has, I'd say, fossiliferous. Let's see here. We find a lot of vertebrate stuff in sandstones. Let's see here. Some beach sandstones can be highly fossiliferous, like we have here in the Manco Shale here in New Mexico. Most of the sandstones that are in the Manco Shale are very fossiliferous, and you can find everything from shells of mollusks to shark teeth. So those sandstones can be pretty fossiliferous. Terrestrial sandstones, on the other hand, are not quite so fossiliferous, but if you know what you're looking for, like the channel sandstones, you know how lags work. A lot of times you can come across some where some bones had been washed into there by a storm event or something like that. Let's see here. Another fossiliferous, shales. Much of the shale that you come across will not have fossils in it. The reason is because the stuff decomposes and stuff a lot of times. Or it just doesn't get preserved very good. A lot of life doesn't. Shale falls apart too. It's really, really exceptional shales come that we see are sometimes like the Kenny Brick Quarry. The shales there preserve a really rich fossil history of the Upper Carboniferous. But if we go back a few million years to the Sandia Formation, the shale that we have. And it, when we like go down to Abbo Pass, which is just maybe about 45-50 miles south, the shale there is so crumbly and so just falls apart. And I mean, it just, you cannot even think about looking for fossils in it because it's just turns back into like the clay. So some shales are really, really bad. Mudstones and siltstones, for the most part, are not too fossiliferous. A lot of times, like the mudstone we have in the Abbo Pass, represents paleosols or soils, the ancient
right.
soils. And like where you live, if you walk across the woods or something like that, you know, and you come across the skeleton, probably the next year you walk out there at the same place, most of that skeleton will be gone, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And that's what happens when you have these basically the soil plains like we see, or the plain of soil like we see in the Abbo Formation. It was just a big low-level floodplain, and life, if it didn't get buried in one of the sandstone or stream lag deposits, it didn't get fossilized, you know. So, probably, like I said, in my experience over about everywhere I've went, limestone is probably your most fossiliferous.
Excellent.
Okay.
Now, the second question was, are many different types of rock found in one period, or are certain types more common to a period?
Actually, practically every kind of rock is available, for the simple reason is we had all these depositional environments and erosional environments, just like we
mm-hmm.
do today. You know, not that much has changed when it comes to that. So along the beaches, you're going to find your beach sandstones in the seas and oceans that are surrounding the continent itself. That's where you're going to always find limestone. Sometimes shales that will be intermixed with those limestones. If you look at terrestrial deposits, you will find a lot of times in depositional environments where you'll have, like the Abbo Formation, as I mentioned, you'll have where there were the soils and all the critters that lived among that. We see slight evidences of fossils and stuff. But you'll see the stream channels in the where the streams used to be, because a lot of times those will be buried and fossilized. Now, one thing to remember when we're talking about this here is not every area is a depositional environment. And there's this is one thing I'd like to stress, and it's hard to get some people to understand this, I've noticed. There's some people out there that just seem to be lost in another world, and they should be ashamed of themselves, actually, for this. But not every area was a depositional environment. A lot of it was erosional surfaces, and that, of course, is how we get our sediments where we find our fossils. If there was not erosion, we would not have sediment deposition as like we see it. So that's what you got to look for. So yes, you'll find the land surfaces started out in the Cambrian kind of small.
Mm-hmm.
Because granite had not really formed yet. But once granite started forming, which was basically mixing the basalts with water, and it kind of just frothed up the minerals in it and caused it to float. So that's when we end up with what the continents we see today, with about one quarter of the planet being continental surfaces. So that's all the frothy granite that's been created so far.
But it would be hard to date granite, wouldn't it, Ken?
No, actually, it's not.
Like if I came to you with a piece of granite from Australia, could you look at it and tell me roughly how old it is? Or would you have to do some mineralogical tests to do it, or something like that?
We would have to do a test. And what we would look for in the granite are, that's what's really cool about igneous rocks that we're going to be talking about that here
back,
in a few minutes.
It's
going to be a nice segue.
Yeah.
It's a nice segue. There are crystals that form in these igneous rocks when it's melted. And granite starts out as melted, just a melted froth of minerals. And as
mm-hmm.
it cools, these crystals grow and grow and grow. Well, growing along with all the minerals that make up a granite, like feldspars and quartzes and micas and such, are zircon crystals. And zircons are wonderful crystals because they are able to record when the rock was laid down, basically, by when uranium atoms get locked into the zircon crystals. It gets locked in at a certain ratio. Now, for those, and this is what's cool, because this does segue right into the show here. When you measure, now radioactive materials have what they call a half-life, and that means over a certain amount of time, half the material, radioactive material actually breaks down and changes into other elements. But it turns into an isotope of this element, not quite the natural occurring made in the star type of element. See, because you got to remember that there's two, usually like lead, there's two types. There's the lead that was created inside a star, then there's a lead that's created by radioactive decay. Do you know that?
I didn't, actually.
Because, you know, these heavier elements, you know, like uranium is created inside a star. So,
is that why lead is somewhat poisonous to us?
Yeah, lead's not too good for humans and organic life. Yeah, you know, it's kind of a nasty element. But anyway, what happens is this isotope of lead that we're able to discern from like I said, the other naturally occurring lead is just enough different that we can tell the difference between the two. And what we do is we measure the ratio. If half of the uranium has turned into lead, then that's the half-life. We know how how old that would be. And if, once again, half of that lead or uranium gets turned into lead, then we have another half-life. And we are able to keep doing that. And the more lead we have compared to the ratio of uranium gives us a fairly accurate date. And Ken, we're able to start, when I'm seeing some of the new dates that we're finding on a lot of these rocks, we're able to act almost accurately determine within a few thousand years or a few tens of thousand years, like in the Abbo Formation here, where I'm working in the overall time scale, you know, within just thousands of years.
Very cool.
Yeah.
It's a great thing that we found out.
It is. Yeah, the Curies and all those who discovered radioactive materials way back when, you know, give us this wonderful tool. Now, volcanoes are the same way. Volcanoes are made up of molten rock, and when an eruption occurs, the pressures underneath actually kind of cause them to squirt out, you know, just like you shake up a soda bottle, you know, the soda comes out, the gases and stuff inside are what, and pressures help force it out, and you get your explosions. But once again, the atomic clock is set when we get these layers of ash and layers of lava from these volcanoes. And we can then start going back from there, start determining the ratio of these, between the zircons, once again, of the uranium and lead, and we can measure the dates. And it's kind of interesting because one of the volcanoes I want to mention here in just a bit is the Jemez Caldera here in central New Mexico, one of the largest calderas in the world. It's visible from space.
Wow.
You know, it's so massive. And I've been inside it many times, collected minerals in it, went fishing in it even. So.
All right, so there's a lake in there?
Man-made lake. Now, there used to be a natural occurring lake, but it's mostly now just some spring areas, et cetera, because of the softer rock. Kind of the water slowly. Volcanic rock is interesting. It, believe it or not, you know, you look at it and say, wow, it's rock. You know, it's going to last a long time. But volcanic rock actually starts breaking apart almost immediately as soon as it hits air. The minerals start oxidizing. They start converting. Rains start converting a lot of the minerals into clays. That's where we get a lot of our clay comes from, volcanic rock.
It's actually quite acidic, isn't it, Ken?
Yeah, there's usually a lot of sulfuric acid inside the volcanic activity and stuff. So it does. It comes out fairly acidic. That's interesting about that. But Let's see. Anyway, that's how we're able to date the rocks.
Excellent.
Like I said. Now, this is another thing that's kind of cool. This is actually, we'll be talking about this on a couple episodes from now. It's like the seafloor spreading and measuring the amount of zircons the lead uranium ratio in the seafloor magmas, the seafloor basalt.
Mm-hmm.
And the further away we get from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, the older the rocks get. So we are able to accurately measure how rapidly the Atlantic Ocean has been spreading because of this radioactive dating.
And that all ties in with continental drift too, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, it's one of the driving forces. Now, interestingly enough, tonight's episode and that episode actually share a lot in common, okay?
All right.
Yeah, they do. They kind of feed one another. But what we do want to talk about here tonight, too, is how volcanoes have affected life on Earth, because they've had a major impact. Now, we're all familiar with Mount St. Helens, I believe, right?
I have heard that of that one, Ken.
Okay. let's see here. Where do we want to start here on this here? Because I guess we should probably maybe talk about some of the type of volcanic eruptions, Ken, or volcanoes.
Okay.
Because
that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, there are several types. Now, one of the interesting types, probably main types that we see, are what's called shield volcanoes. And they usually erupt a low viscosity lava. Now, interestingly enough, we have shield volcanoes right here where I live, one of the lava sheets that we drive by when we go out to the west here, about an hour drive. Not even quite that far. It's actually fairly close, over to Lucero Uplift, about 35 miles from here. It's a shield eruption where the lava just came up and spilled out, and they estimated that the viscosity of the lava that was flowing in some of these areas, it flowed for about 35, 40 miles or so from its eruption center. This is what was interesting. And this is what, like I said, this volcanic center is just to the west of me. That's one thing interesting. You know, it's an interesting thing here about New Mexico for our listeners. It's full of geology, just absolutely full of geology. I mean, you got hard rock like tonight, volcanoes everywhere, and you've got wonderful soft rock from Precambrian up to recent stuff. You know, just everything you want to find here is here. And we've explored this lava field, Ken. It's so cool, to be able to explore it and also its source over west here.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been estimated that the viscosity of the lava that was flowing out of this particular eruption was close to 10 W10 oil, I think, 10 weight oil. Really?
Wow.
Yeah, really flowing, And but it followed a valley. It flowed north for a while, then it turned and went towards the east and finally petered out over towards the Lucero Uplift. Now, a lot of it's also been eroded away. That's a type of shield.
Is that where all the minerals come from that are found in New Mexico, from all that eroded igneous rock?
Actually,
to a degree.
To a degree, interestingly enough, the mineral activity here that we have here in New Mexico is really well known for gold, silver, and tons of other kinds of minerals. I mean, it's really a mineral-rich state. But the really interesting thing, most of the gold minerals and silver-bearing minerals and some of the others were actually laid down around 40 million years ago. Rifting in the valley here started. It started allowing these intrusions, cracking the basement granites and the basement quartzites. You remember, for our listeners, we talked about the Sandia Mountains and the Manzano Mountains, how they're 1.2 to 1.8 billion years old. And but about 40 million years ago or so, in the Eocene period, there was a major upheaval going through the area, and the rocks were cracked, and a lot of mineral-rich fluids worked their way into these fissures in these rocks all around the state as the mountain building activity was happening, the orogeny of the Rocky Mountain building here. And this fracturing led to these mineral-rich waters. I mean, they were highly acidic. They were full of gold and all this other kind of stuff, and it precipitated out. I think we had a visit to the Kelly Gold Mine. Did we talk about that one show, I think?
Yes, yeah, we did.
And it is the amount of minerals there. It's amazing that they came from this mineral-rich water that was in. And some of this stuff is cool because you see where the rock is all crunched and crumpled up, where it was actually right there at the pressure points of the fracturing, you know? And in this rock conglomerate, it's got kind of like a brickated conglomerate, but it's not from stream activity. It's from tectonic activity. And it's all cemented back together with just with minerals like galena, pyrite. Oh my God, what were some of the others? There's so many minerals in it. That it was just fantastic. But all these minerals cemented it back together, you know, and that's what they were mining to get all the gold and all this other stuff out, because it was just, you know, mineral rich.
Wow. Well, that's a really good explanation, actually.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Sense.
Yeah, fantastic, isn't it? Well, now here's an interesting thing too. When we talk about some of the mineral-rich stuff, and as we mentioned, that the Abel Formation here in New Mexico and is usually has a lot of what they call copper mineralization, and they believe the copper in it actually came from the basement granites of the Pedernal Uplift, and up north had been out of the Uncompahgre. And the coppers were actually coming out of those Precambrian granites. And that's how they got their copper, yeah. Oh, and another thing. Boy, we're going all over the place on geology here, Ken.
Well,
because this is interesting for our readers here. I just got to bring this point up.
Right.
We was out in the field the other day down in the Abel Pass, and we happened to see these truck with people that had this ERRG, I think it was, on the side of their truck. And being curious, we seen that one of the copper mines that we collected fossil bones at appeared that they were using the trail driving by it. So when we stopped and talked to these people, we found out that there was a geologist, an engineer, and I forget what the other person was working, but they were actually cleaning up several Permian sandstone-based uranium sites, uranium mines.
Wow.
Yeah. And,
were you aware that that existed there?
Well, I knew that uranium could be found at some of these sites, but they were never really productive.
Right.
And but it was interesting to find out that one of the most productive, though, they were actually doing a cleanup on it. It was one of the emergency energy things, cleanup things, and they were removing the radioactive materials from the area.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, found out that the radioactive material was the copper oxides. I mean, the uranium oxides that precipitates around organic material. I don't know whether it was a bone site or not. We didn't get a chance to talk to them too much about that. They didn't seem to really know too much about the fossil stuff out there in the area because, well. So it was interesting to see that, though. You know, they were out there cleaning up in the Abel Pass uranium mines. So I've always suspected that Chile copper mine, we got this one yellowish sandstone kind of breaks up, and I've always felt that I might be wading around in uranium. So
you're going to have to get yourself a dog account, Ken.
I know. I got a friend that's got one. It's really interesting. And actually, when I was a prototype machinist, I used to help build Geiger counters when I was working at one machine shop, help machine parts for them. So it's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, shield volcanoes. Like I said, that's like the Hawaiian Islands and what we see here. There are also lava dome type volcanoes, and that's what we call use what's with a highly viscous lava, which is usually a really thick one. And this is the kind of eruption that happened like Mount St. Helens. Now, Mount St. Helens, there's something called the Ring of Fire, and I'm sure most of our knowledgeable listeners out there have heard of it. But basically what it is around the tectonic activity, the tectonic activity of the plates where they are either moving against each other or some of them are being subducted underneath like the continental plates. Granite always rides over basalt, always does. You rarely do you ever see a granite form going down because the granite is so light. It just basically floats back to the surface, melts and floats back up.
Ken, when you say Ring of Fire, to me that means the Pacific Ocean. Is there also a Ring of Fire around the Atlantic Ocean?
You know, it's interesting, but yes, basically it does. The whole Ring of Fire does encompass both the Atlantic and the Pacific, and they do actually merge together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically one continent, one continuous break that goes all around the globe. Part of it on the... it even includes the Mid-Atlantic Ridge.
Wow.
Yeah. And now this is what's interesting is when we look at it, when we look like along the west coast of North America and the west coast of South America, we have this mountain building that we see. Once we start getting here like into New Mexico and Colorado and up into Wyoming, we start getting into the Front Range, and then we get into all the basin and range mountain ranges that form from that point onto the coast. And if you look at how these mountains are arranged, you see that they run kind of parallel to the coast, have a north and south, north and south tendency to their ridges. And that's, of course, because of the great pressures pushing up along the whole continent. It's just kind of like a rug is causing the rocks to, rise and dip. Because one of the interesting things about rock, and when I learned back in geology, rock is plastic. It actually flows, it bends, especially when it's down deep under a lot of pressure and a lot of heat. We see that it's able to do that when we look at things like gneisses, schist. Schist is a real good metamorphic rock. It's metamorphosized granite, I believe. But you can see where the rock had actually flowed when it's been melted, and you can see this in the minerals, how they're laid. You can see it in other things. Even when you look at some marbles, some of the marbles have actually been melted enough, Ken, that the fossils are deformed because of this pressure.
Are they really?
Yeah.
I never realized that.
Yeah, they'll be. You'll see that they kind of are pushed along in a certain direction where they where the pressure was kind of flowing. The plastic rock, and it's really fascinating. It's this here. So. Anyway, the Mount St. Helens is, I guess you can say they are slow eruptions of highly viscous lava, kind of like Mount Encino outside of Mount St. Helens, that dome that formed. Lassen Peak is also can be called a dome lava. The Jemez Caldera in north central New Mexico here. It is has lava domes in it that after the original eruption, more lava was vented out. And I believe the Jemez Caldera has exploded several times, and violent explosions. It blew ash for hundreds of miles around the Jemez Caldera. We even find exposures of ash as far away as here.
Wow. There's so much power in them, isn't there?
It's, well...
And they can hurl so far.
when you look at the you know, the immensity of the earth and stuff, and yet you look at the power that's going on, and it's like, you know what, I'm actually surprised the crust is as stable as it is. Because we are talking a lot of power, a lot of, you know, immense powers. And you know what's really interesting, though, when you look at this, as much energy that there is being released from the core, you know, that there's core. Let's talk a little bit here about that, Ken, because we got to have a driving force for volcanics. You know, tectonics and volcanoes take kind of an interesting set of circumstances. Not all celestial bodies that we know about actually have volcanism or tectonics on them. And probably one of the driving forces behind Earth's tectonics is that its core towards the center of it has a lot of radioactive material, and they're giving off a lot of radioactive heat. And that is keeping keeping the heat radiates out through the outer core, you know, made of nickel and iron. You know, so because the pressure on it, it's kept at a, you know, mostly a metallic state, you know, kind of an interesting state. Because it, as it rotates on the inner core, it generates an electromagnetic field or magnetic field around the Earth. You know, it's really fascinating dynamic. If it wasn't for that field, too, you know, we wouldn't have life on Earth, because the atmosphere would not be able to deflect the solar radiation, the solar wind.
Well, that's pretty important, man.
Man, everything just works together, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's so fantastic, you know, to see this, you know. But anyway, I think we need to get back to where we were talking about the West
yes.
Coast again here. And the subduction going on. Now, what's happening here is kind of interesting, and I think you're familiar with a lot of the you know, the volcanoes I think that run along the coast range, you know, up in Washington State, Oregon State, along through California, all the way down into South America. These the North American continent is being driven towards the west, and we know this because we have the seafloor spreading on the Atlantic Ocean. And somewhere along the Atlantic Ocean, where we have this split, we have an upwelling of these hot mantle currents down in the mantle, which is below the crust. And here in this mantle, now the mantle is interesting because parts of it closer to the, as you get deeper, get more liquid, and the upper mantle is not quite so liquid. Some places it does produce pockets and vents in it that fill up with hotter liquid magmas from down lower, and we see these here in different areas, these big hot pockets in places like the Hawaiian Islands, and
mm-hmm.
also probably what is going to be one of the most terrifying volcano eruptions in the future, Yellowstone Park.
Yeah, that's supposed to be a super volcano or something, isn't it, Ken?
That it is. And super volcanoes are one of those things that can cause planet-wide extinctions or spatial extinctions in a hemisphere. Not exactly sure. I don't have the information on me on the last time, but I did want to talk about this particular event, one of the Yellowstone eruption events. And I believe that's the one that actually sent ash as far down as away as Nebraska. And in these supervolcanic ash eruption, we actually had one of the most awesome finds, and it was of an enormous amount, large number of I think it was Eocene mammals. And they were preserved in this ash where they were covered. Just kind of like it was a prehistoric Pompeii, basically. And all these skeletons were preserved because they were buried under feet and feet of ash. And when they were finally discovered, you know, we were able to piece together this, that I believe rhinoceros is one of the early rhinoceroses that lived here in North America was one of the victims, and there were other animals as well. But these are one of the times that a volcanic eruption actually preserves fossils, you know.
So it's got to be a lot of things coming together for that to happen there, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a oh boy. When you lead up
normally,
to a,
normally it would just burn everything, wouldn't it?
Well, there's a
surely.
Now this is what's interesting. Yeah, there's an interesting type of volcanic eruption called a Nui Ardent, and it produces something called a lahar. And what this is, it's where you have a volcanic blast of one of the explosive type eruptions, and this cloud of extremely hot gases and particles of volcanic ash are exploded out. They rise up so far because of the heat, and finally what happens is the weight starts bringing everything back down, and it collapses on itself, and it will roll down a valley or something like that, just at supersonic speed almost, and just destroy everything that's passed. Sometimes these temperatures are so hot in one of these here lahars that it will actually vaporize trees, people, animals, before they even know what hits them. They're just instantly turned to steam because of the amount of heat. And if that doesn't kill them, the sandblasting of these extremely hot particles of volcanic glass. That's what the ash is. It's superfine glass particles, basically, when it cools. So you're blasted with that as well. And that's what we see, basically, when we look out and see a lot of the most damaging type of eruptions. These are the ones that do most of the killing.
Wow.
And they're... and. Nothing usually gets far. Well, when you look out, you'll see places like Mount St. Helens, where you have, see the blast round, you know. That's where this lahar, all this ash and the hot gases blasted out when it erupted. And it just levels. It leveled hundreds of square miles, you know, of land around it, of trees and everything, you know, just completely blasted. Now, there's also... interestingly enough, an upside to volcanoes.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
They blast out mineral-rich these mineral-rich rocks and mineral-rich ash enriches the soils out and around. And volcanic soils are usually some of the most productive soils around. And that's why we see a lot of people that live around volcanoes, because the stuff grows really good. And I think one of the most is it Mount Vesuvius in is that in the Mount Vesuvius in Sicily?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or is it? Yeah, I think
yes,
I think it's Mount Vesuvius and Mount Etna. In Mount Etna is in Italy, I believe.
Yep.
And both of these were known, you know, for their explosive eruptions, but. Interestingly enough, you see people living up under, you know, for the size of these. When the interesting thing about a volcano is if it goes out of, it doesn't erupt very often, a lot of times it goes out of the, you know, the popular memory. And people, a lot of times, you know, will not realize that they're living, you know, on such a ticking time bomb.
Would not be good in some instances.
Well, it never is. I think it wasn't too long ago that was that big old eruption down on, in the Philippines, you know, and
Pinatubo.
Yeah, Pinatubo, and you know, and the trouble that it, you know it caused, you know, it was just you know devastating.
Actually, Ken, Mary made an observation. If there was were no volcanoes, there'd be no mechanism to relieve the stresses, the internal stresses on the planet, and the whole planet would explode, wouldn't it?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think we might have to step off of Earth here for a minute to kind of see what might happen. Let's go to Venus. Okay? We just we're leaving here the volcanoes here on Earth. We're gonna rocket to Venus here real quick. Now Venus is interesting. When they started exploring Venus, they found basically that it apparently did not have much of an old surface. You know, it appears like it was fairly fairly new, I guess you could say. So what they have hypothesized that happens at Venus, because there's no apparent volcanic activity or tectonic release because the atmospheric pressure, et cetera, there's a lot going on Venus. But every so often that the pressures build up in it and the whole crustal surface basically turns over. You know, just
everything.
Everything, yeah. Just so once it starts splitting, you know, it splits and roils and everything, because there's no way for there's not been much of a mechanism for release of the heat on Venus, you know. So, but that's one theory. So what would probably happen is the heat build up, you know, enough. But let's go the other direction now. Let's say there's not enough heat to cause for volcanoes and tectonic activity. So what we see is something like on the moon, where we see that there is a little bit of heat down deep inside the moon, but for the most part, the moon doesn't have volcanics or tectonic activities or anything going on it. You know, it's cooled off so much that that doesn't happen. So basically, when you start doing that, the heat just kind of slowly dissipates out until finally one day, the moon will be a cold body. Man, we're back up the top of the hour again, Ken. Volcanoes just are flying by on us.
They're hitting there. Yeah, they certainly are hitting there. Well, there you go. Actually, I've got a question for you, Ken. Just say there was a bend in the river. All the animals that have died and fallen into the river, all the bones are building up there as they want to, and they're slowly covered by sand, or quickly covered by sand, actually, and they start to fossilize. Now, if there's a volcanic eruption that covers that area, it wouldn't necessarily damage the fossilizing bone underneath, but would the weathering of that contribute to the mineralization of the bones underneath?
That's an interesting question, actually. There's a possibility that would happen. But there's another interesting thing, too. A lot of times those eruptions actually help cover the bones and stuff even better.
Right.
So
okay.
They're more prone to fossilization. Now here's the best thing about that, Ken. We get a time clock right there. Bang! If you've got a layer of bones that's just setting in to be fossilized and you've got a layer of volcanic ash deposit right on top of that, we can just about date it to the year, you know, of when that eruption happened. And matter of fact, we are able to do that. There are many areas, like here in the Southwest, where volcanic activity back in the Cretaceous period has left a layer of fossils, a layer of volcanic ash, a layer of fossils, a layer of volcanic ash, a layer of fossils. So we get to see this wonderful picture here. We know when this happened. We know when this event happened. We know when these – I mean, it's beautiful when we have an area where we get exactly that.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's
– Well, an asset in that case.
It is. Volcanics have been wonderful when it comes to stuff like that. They've actually, what's interesting is volcanoes, unless you got something like the super volcano Yellowstone that can cause, problems, you know, thousands of miles away, most volcanoes are probably better for the Earth than they are destructive. They were here before humans evolved. They've been here a part of the planet, you know, since before life evolved, actually, because the planet was hot as it coalesced. The meteor and asteroid bombardment of the first few hundred million years was going on at the beginning. So everything was, temperatures were high. And once the Earth started cooling down a little bit, the volcano, now this is interesting, the volcanoes were doing most of contributing to the atmosphere back at the beginning. The atmosphere was a lot different. It was mostly methane gases, carbon dioxides, sulfur dioxides, a whole lot of really noxious chemicals for the simple fact that oxygen was not available and free in the atmosphere because photosynthesizing organisms had not evolved yet. So these chemicals, though, all actually help to contribute to the soup of life. When organic chemicals are interesting because a lot of organic chemicals, when they come into contact with each other, actually start doing interesting things. You know, we start seeing molecules grow. We start seeing proteins forming. We start seeing fatty acids forming, just out of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. And these chemicals were outgassed into the atmosphere, and they also dissolved out of the rocks and into the waters were these chemical reactions. And it's interesting because some of the studies on life indicate that possibly the higher temperatures as the waters and stuff cooled down with all these chemicals were led to the naturing of these higher molecules like proteins and stuff. And it's almost like the metabolism of these chemicals came first and then organic biology set in. So there's an interesting thing. So volcanoes probably contributed immensely to the formation of life on Earth too. So overall, volcanoes are, interesting glimpses into the center of the Earth. Now, there's other type of volcanic eruptions too. Down in southern New Mexico, we got a really interesting one, and see if I can remember what the type of volcano it is. What type of explosion is where mostly gases are blown out and not so much lava or rocky material or ash. And this actually just blows out large chunks of the surrounding rock. And down in Kilbourne Hole is the name of this particular feature. And it actually has rocks from deep inside the mantle blown up, Ken, because they have some of the largest Oh, the mineral's right on the tip of my tongue that comes from down deep. I should have had this. Maybe it'll come to me here in a few minutes. But at any rate, these crystals are from down at the lower mantle. And it shows us, activity that's actually going on deeper, too. So it's really fascinating stuff when you start studying volcanoes because they do give us glimpses by their magma composition, what's going on underneath our feet.
And that's very important, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, even right now, it's interesting, how do humans utilize volcanoes, for other things? Well, this is kind of cool. Over just on the other side of the Rio Grande River, about 17, 18 miles away, Ken, is another, once again, a series of volcanic cones. You can see them from my house here. They're cinder cones.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually harvesting, mining the pumice from these here, grinding it up, and they're using it to pave our roads here in central New Mexico. So we're driving on volcanic pumice that's only about 100,000 years old. These are young volcanoes.
Wow.
And some of the youngest around here are only a few thousand years old. So we've got some volcanic activity right here in central New Mexico where I live that is fairly recent. The cones haven't eroded down yet. They still got the ice cones. They're so young.
Is there anything down there that's recent as in recent to us? If you know what I mean.
I think there's a couple places that the eruptions are less than 1,000 years old.
Oh, right.
Yeah, the Indian salt.
Yes,
yes.
Well, I found the three different types of volcanoes, Ken. I don't know if that
yeah,
can
should,
help you.
Well, there should be shield volcanoes, lava domes, cryptodomes, cinder cones, stratovolcanoes, and the super volcanoes, submarine volcanoes, of course, subglacial volcanoes, mud volcanoes.
This says it's kind of divided into three groups. The stratovolcanoes are composite volcano,
mm-hmm.
a cinder cone volcano, and a shield volcano.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting.
And what's really, yeah, well, this is what you would like, Mary, if you got to come out here. I could take
mm-hmm.
you, like I said earlier, we got the shield volcano eruption. We go just over to, across the river here, and I could take you on a cinder cone volcano. Up north by Albuquerque, we have the Seven Sisters volcanoes, and they're cinder cones, and they're interesting. There's one really cool one just west of here, a volcano that's so cool, Bandera volcano. And now this is what's interesting, guys, here, is there's a they have what they call the ice caves over here. Now, this volcanic field is about 60 miles east of or west of here, and it's above, it's all along the continental divide, but it's also high enough in altitude that the ice in it doesn't melt during the summertime. So it's, this is inside the lava tubes. In the lava that flowed out, and I've actually been to one of these ice tubes in August, and you go down there and you got this big old the thing's just filled with ice from the last ice age. It's still melting slowly.
Well, what can I say? That's marvelous.
It's cool.
You know, you just wouldn't expect that, would you?
Yeah, like I said, the first time I saw it, it was interesting, and you can still go over there to this day, and you can see this ice age ice that's very, very slowly melting back just a few inches of summer, and that's all it can get because it gets back, winter hits again.
Wow.
So volcanoes are really cool. You know, what can you say about them? You know, when I've walked on lava flows and walked on top of these cinder cones. I've been on top of these volcanic necks out here in New Mexico. You know, you're looking at some of the building blocks of life and building blocks of the earth, you know. So without volcanoes, I don't think life as we know it would be here today.
Well, that shows you we got to look for volcanic planets.
Yeah. Well, and I do recommend our readers, there's a lot out there to learn about volcanics and hard rock geology. This show here tonight just barely, we just barely glimpsed on this here.
I mean,
because there's so much more. And because there's so much more I could talk about, like the volcanic fields out west and ones down south here in New Mexico. I've even seen spatter cones, you know, where the lava's being pushed out, you know, bubbled out, bloop, 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 you know, and you see where the lava's spattered all around it, you know. I've also got lava bombs I was able to collect for some of the lava fields. That's cool, you know, to find these where the lava was blasted out into the air, and as it fell back to earth, you could see where it flew through the air and took on these shapes, you know, before it hit the ground. And I even got some, you can see where they were still liquid enough when it hit the ground, as it's flattened on one side.
Oh, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, like
excellent.
I said, you know,
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I'll have to get some pictures and stuff of these lava bomb stuff that we've collected and everything. And we've collected several different kinds of obsidian glass, volcanic glass. I've got black obsidian that's really pure. I've got marble obsidian from the Jemez Caldera that's not so pure. You know, so really, so interesting. I've got some interesting volcanic rocks in my collection as well. So I hope everybody enjoyed our show tonight about what we could talk about real quick on volcanoes.
Oh, I'm sure it was excellent. I've just refreshed the page, so I haven't done what I did last week and missed any questions, so that's good.
Yeah. Well, you and I, Ken, have got a really great show next week on the Pine Art. We're going to talk about asteroids and meteors, and their effect on extinction events, and also how they possibly were one of the contributing factors to life on Earth. You know, so that's going to be another fantastic show. You know, so
I'm looking forward to that one. It should be very interesting.
Yeah, well, and we'll see what there's. Now this is going to be fun too, because to our listeners, we're going to go into outer space. Another one of my favorite subjects I had since I was a kid is astronomy, believe it or not. And you wouldn't. Well, I don't want to brag, but yeah, I know quite a bit about astronomy. You know, it's once again how and you got to understand astronomy for paleontology. When you think back and you look at how life evolved on the Earth, and you look at the age of the Earth in the galactic point, you know, from the galactic point, 25 revolutions, you think about all that time we're going around this galaxy. You know, the star patterns are changing around us as our sun is just up and down and across and through the planes. And it's rotated around the galaxy 25 or so times, or maybe more or less, you know. And mm-hmm. to think of all this astronomical events that we're going as that we are speeding through space. And now not only are we rotating on our galaxy, but you got to remember, our galaxy is moving too, you know. So when you start looking and putting this all into perspective, you know, it's like, you know, we're all in motion. And in my lifetime of over 60 years, you know, I wonder how many millions of miles around the galaxy that I've managed to cover. How many millions of miles has our galaxy moved in space since I was born? You know, so that's something to ponder for our listeners out there.
There's some research, so you can formulate some questions for us next week.
Yeah, so join us next week as Ken and I take on space and asteroid strike. So with that there, Ken, I want to mention to everybody that you and I are going to be at the KLAC show next month. They need to stop in. Any of our listeners are going to be in that area up in Canada. Come and visit us. Ken and I are going to be a blast together. We have Ron Bishop, the other Tank Topic host, joining us. And we're going to be some crazy old men. I think Ron wants to get crazy with us. So we might have to go out and we'll see what happens.
We'll just have to see what we can do about that, won't we, Kent?
Hey, take me to a Canadian nudie bar.
I don't think my wife would appreciate that.
There's a joke that I'll tell you about.
I've got a few, too.
Yeah.
Behave.
any rate, it's going to be fun when they get us together there at in London, Ontario on the
20th. We'll be doing a show from here too, won't we?
Our goal is to go out and visit the Devonian outcrops in your area and do exploring, and we'll talk about our finds on the show and what the rocks are and stuff, and I think it'll be a fantastic show to talk about our day in the field together.
Yeah, that's going to be fantastic, I think.
Well, I'm so looking forward to that. Oh man, I'm so looking forward to that. There, I don't care if it's raining. We're going to go out together on that, and have a wonderful time. We'll post pictures on our website for everybody to see, and you'll be able to see Ken and myself, the two Kens together, collecting rocks, and who knows what else. You know, we're going to have a great time. I know that. So join us there. So at any rate, we want to mention real quick here that you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Also, you can go to our YouTube channel for Nature's Talk Show. We've got some great stuff happening on there. Definitely go check it out. We also want you to go to www.blogtalkradio.com/NTS and click the follow button there for us, please. We want everybody to please do that. If you haven't, please do that. It helps our show. So you can go to Nature's Talk Show website. Ken and I and Mary and Tom, we've all got kind of really great stuff up there. You can sign up for our newsletter. You should do that. Hit the PayPal button if you want to help donate to our show. If you don't want to just donate, you can go visit our store where we got coffee mug shirts and all kinds of great stuff like that. As Ken mentioned, we're in the chat room with you folks, and we field your questions and ideas on the show all the time. And if we miss your question the first show, as Ken brought up before the show, we'll answer it first thing next episode. So you can count on us for that there as well. I guess that's about it, Ken.
Sponsors. What did you mean, Mary? I'm sorry.
Well, we are looking for some great sponsors for Nature's Talk Show. We have lots of opportunities for anyone who would like to sponsor the show. You just need to get a hold of Ken Borman, Ken McKeon, Tom, or I, and we can give you all the information that you're going to need. Mm-hmm. So let us know how we can help you and your business, and we'd be happy to do that.
Yeah, and remember, we've been on the air now going on nearly a half a decade. So,
yep.
So we've been around, and we're going to be around a lot longer because we won't let Mary quit, and Mary won't let us quit.
Oh, heck no. You guys are stuck.
Yeah, well, I feel like our listeners out there, we do have a duty to bring information to you, and that's, you know, we need to enlighten the world because there's so much darkness out there that parades itself around as light, and that darkness needs to be pointed out. And those of us who know the light of knowledge and the light of the scientific study and stuff like that, we need to shine and let people know that we want a beautiful future for our planet. And let's get out of the dark ages of ignorance and move into the future out there in the galaxy. So with that.
Well said, Ken.
Ah,
mm-hmm.
So thank you. So with that, I want to thank our listeners, and we'll talk to you here coming up. Next episode of Nature's Talk Show. Bye-bye.
And that's good night for me.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.